And we're back. Welcome to the government. I'm Alex, and with me, as always, is James. If you missed our last episode 14 years ago, it was on the man who would be king. The end of that.
It was on the Clinton scandal.
At the end of that podcast, we had a huge argument and decided that we would only do another podcast if the Raptors ever made the finals, and the impossible has happened. So here we are. We're back. Back at it.
How perfectly timed this ended up being, really.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, themcguffinman.com is still our website. We still hold that domain. You can check out all our old stuff.
Still squatting.
Yeah, exactly. Still haven't been kicked off by whatever, like, DNS people on the server. And
I've been doxxed, but I'm not stepping down.
I have not stopped writing, so whether you view that as a positive, you can continue to read some things on the website and just listen to our old podcasts. I think this is the first time we'll be doing a movie from this millennium since our world famous Gentleman Broncos podcast, so mm-hmm. Do a deep dive. But yeah, the MacGuffman. .com. I forgot that, but that was a good cliffhanger through the theme song. We're rusty, but we're back. So what are we talking about today?
As I teased before the theme song, we're talking about something very appropriate because it is game one of the Raptors finals tonight, and we're talking about High Flying Bird.
Yes.
Which is a basketball movie, a Steven Soderbergh movie, so checking a couple of Alex's boxes here. Mm-hmm. And as you stated, a fairly recent movie. So,
yeah, it came out in February, first week of February, I believe. And it seems like a movie I willed into existence, basically.
Yeah. And how did this make much of a splash with people besides you?
I don't think so. I think you're the first person I've talked. Oh, sorry. My friend Angela has seen it at my insistence. My friend Mandy will see it eventually at my promise that Kyle MacLachlan is featured in a sauna at one point. So she'll watch that. I have drunkenly tried to convince anybody who would listen to me that it's a fantastic movie. But I don't think I've been able to get anybody else to actually watch it.
Yeah, I'll get it out of the way. I thought it was quite good, and I thought it was better watching it the second time around. And I didn't really know what to expect, and that's typical of a Soderbergh movie. And, I mean, it is as advertised. It is a film about an agent trying to kind of make his way through an NBA lockout season, and I guess attempt to bring it to the end is what would be his goal. But it's not as straightforward as that makes it seem. It's, you know, there are sports in this movie, but you see very little basketball being played. Yeah.
You see approximately five jump shots, three of which are taken by an agent.
Yeah, and kids running laps.
Yeah.
So it's you know, it's got some things that are unexpected in just its tone and its style. But I really did enjoy it, and I really didn't know what to expect, and I was pleasantly surprised, even still.
Yeah, I was, as potentially the biggest Soderbergh fan who's ever existed, I was surprised, by everything. It's written by, Terrell McCraney, who famously has wrote the play that inspired the film Moonlight, got a co-screenwriting credit on that with Barry Jenkins. And this is very much a playwright movie, which I don't think I really anticipated coming in. I think we've spoken about how much I love those movies, Glengarry Glen Ross being our most prominent example of a movie we've actually done. I've never seen the movie Sweet Smell of Success, but that was another point of inspiration for Soderbergh and McCraney and Andre Holland, who was also a part of the inception of the actual idea. And I just wasn't anticipating that. I certainly wasn't anticipating the first voice in this movie that you hear being belonging to Steven Soderbergh. I was very excited about that when the player interviews, interviewing Reggie Jackson, Karl Anthony Towns, and Donovan Mitchell, three NBA players, and those interviews are interspersed throughout. I thought that was a really nice touch, and and I think the way that the movie turns the story of a sports agent and one of his players into a sort of like business heist movie. I should have seen it coming from Soderbergh because he likes to turn everything into a heist movie, but I somehow didn't. And that's the beauty of Soderbergh. Like you can know him so well and, think you know what you're going to get, and somehow delivers it to you in a way you didn't expect.
Yeah. Right. And so a couple things there. First, what's so playwrighty about it to you?
Just the pace of the dialogue and the way that nobody speaks like a human being. everybody speaks like the same human being, and that same human being loves Aaron Sorkin, you know, like, or the pace of that characters talk in Aaron Sorkin movies. There are so many, like, there's a Fiona Apple, what I think is a Fiona Apple reference halfway through the movie. Where Ray just says heavy with mood to follow up something Sonia Sohn, her character's name is Myra, says, and it's like half quoting a Fiona Apple song, and I had to do research to figure it out, and I was like, I think that's a Fiona Apple song, and like I can't find any confirmation, but like these just some references that are just weird, and a lot of which I don't get. Like there are plenty of lines in this movie that I do not understand the meaning of.
Right.
And I think that's the key to a playwright movie, is that there are lines that the writer doesn't care whether or not you understand them.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, that tends to be a trait of playwrights. They don't care about you at all.
Yeah. And all these people are just very clever. I mean, there's a lot of these people who would be, intelligent people, obviously, to reach the level of success that they've reached, but just to be that pithy is, yeah, that's some play or screenwriting, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And then, so the heist angle to it, I mean, Soderbergh would have been, I guess, still most famous for Ocean's movies?
Yeah, if I'm trying to describe who Steven Soderbergh is to people, I either say the Ocean's movies or Traffic. That's pretty,
yeah,
those
right
are the two big ones.
And I guess Out of Sight would be up there, right?
I don't think so. I think like it's like the B tier. Like it's the top of the B tier when you're trying to describe Soderbergh. That right there with Aaron Brockovich.
The sixth and seventh man, if you will.
Sure.
to stay on topic here. yeah, but I mean, for the Oceans to be the ones that are big, and for this to be you know, as you said, a business heist movie, and a lot of people have pointed that out, that it is something that he has done so many times before, and for it to still sneak by you is, I mean, it's rather heisty on its own, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
You mentioned Andre Holland. I'll just say that I think everyone does a very good job acting in this movie as well.
Yes, I think Andre Holland is fantastic. I mean, if Andre Holland isn't good in this movie's a failure, you know, like it's such an important, performance. Yes, I agree. Everybody is good, but, I think him and, Zazie Beetz, both stand out to me. I mean, Bill Duke is just always a pleasant, like a person I'm happy to see. Same with Sonia Sohn. Just, I mean, that is true of pretty much the whole cast. I mean, I've only seen Melvin, is it Greg? What's his last name? Yeah, Melvin Gregg, the alleged turd burglar from American Vandal season 2, who plays Eric in this movie. I've only seen him in American Vandal, but he's great in both this and American Vandal.
Yeah, another little treat for you in this movie.
Yeah. And that the guy from True Detective season 1, the villain from True Detective season 1, for coming in for two lines towards the end.
Yeah.
Which is a nice touch.
Yeah, and so this movie, I mean, this takes place in 2011, right?
I don't think they specify it, but judging by the phones, I don't think it does. I think it, because 2011, I feel like everybody in this movie still, or specifically the agents, still have Blackberries, and this is an iPhone movie. I think it sort of takes place in it's definitely inspired by the 2011 lockout, but I think it takes place in this, like, in 2018. probably 2018, 2019, something like that.
Yeah, I guess they mentioned the Stepson and Durant as the
yes,
people who are.
That is true. That's,
yeah, yeah. Without getting too bogged down in the technology thing.
But they do also mention Kobe, who's been out of the league for a few years.
That's right, they do.
And I should point out that Ray raises resistance to the mention of Kobe, which makes me very happy.
But, yes, yes.
For a variety of reasons.
Yeah, no, I just bring up the timeline because it just this feels like a very forward-thinking movie. It just seems like a movie that is very much of its time, but maybe even ahead of its time. And I just got that sense from, I mean, the reason I brought up 2011, maybe I saw that that was the last lockout.
It was, yeah.
And this movie was, the ball's kind of been rolling on this movie for a few years. But I just feel that this, if you watch this movie in a couple years, it just seems like it's going to still be very present.
Yeah, I mean, watch it in 2021 during the next lockout. And and I bet, I don't know, I hope, LeBron will be falling off by that point, but whoever the current version of LeBron is in 2021, I hope when that lockout happens, he's seen High Flying Bird, because I think that would be pretty interesting. But yeah, I do think it is ahead of its time, and, you know, like there's an argument to be made about whether or not some of the ideas in this movie are actually realistic. I think the movie questions whether or not the ideas that Ray has are realistic in the long term. But just
the ideas about streaming these things and the owners, the players having control of them, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but like there's a portion of this movie where it seems like Ray actively just wants to. I mean, they never say the NBA in this movie, I don't think, presumably because they would get sued, but leaving their version of the NBA in the dust entirely. It feels like at one point in the movie, Ray is trying to do that, and then he sort of it comes to when he's explaining it all to Spence towards the end. He just wants to hold the game in his hands so the owners know that he can, basically. Then that he sort of vocalizes that his goals are more short term from this standpoint, and then the idea at the end of the movie is that there's a long-term goal still being focused on, but this short-term work had to be done first.
Yeah. Okay, and so you think that he's, I mean, we shouldn't maybe talk about the ending till closer to the
end. Yeah, let's leave the end till the end. Yeah.
Yeah, I just think that you know, him talking to Eric about YouTube and that already seeming like a thing of the past, you know, maybe jumping the gun a bit, but the idea that, you know, Netflix and Facebook want into the live streaming thing, and your gentleman there from season two of True Detective saying
season
how
one.
He's getting season one, yeah, getting phone ads about the different you know, games that they're doing without the league.
Bring your ring 3-on-3.
Oh, so good. Yeah. That just seemed very, you know, it just seemed very of the current moment, and you know, who knows what happens in the next few years when it comes to tech and, you know, that angle of it. But it just seemed very seamlessly woven in, and not just you know, we talk about certain shows and movies that's, you know, are angling for a young crowd, and just you know, they ask some intern, you know, what's the hottest app right now? Like, it just seemed, and maybe I'm just slightly out of touch, but it just seemed very, very organic and seamless. And I thought that that just added to the realism of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think that's part of why I think this movie's set, you know, closer to today than 2011, right? Because I think about what happened during the NBA lockout, like what players were doing during the lockout in 2011. A lot of them played in the Drew League, which is a famous league in Los Angeles. It's invite only. And I think now if the lockout happened, the Drew League would be streaming games. Like James Harden's playing in these games. I think he's played for a couple summers, but I think Kobe played in the Drew League in 2011 during the lockout. And I think that's what would happen. There are these smaller leagues that exist on a much smaller community level and just don't. I mean, the Drew League's sponsored by Nike, so it's well known, but it's, you know, it's not the NBA. And I think what would happen is if another lockout happened, people would immediately start scouring contracts to see how they can televise things like this, things that are already like a mildly recognizable brand, and just be like, have LeBron tweet, hey, I'm in this game tomorrow at 2 p.m. Watch it on Facebook, you know?
Yeah, and then just find some venture capitalist or somebody to inject a few million dollars into it, and just how easy it is to find things and for people to view things without having to go through a ton of hoops or buy a bunch of new hardware. Mm-hmm. It just seems like these things would pop up so quickly if there was a locker, like if there's any dearth of this product that people so clearly love. And it is fun listening to them talk about basketball so frankly, as I'm sure agents like Ray would. Mm-hmm. Just that basketball, it's the sport, or I mean NBA, the league, either way. I might use them interchangeably here by accident, but yeah. It's the league of the major leagues most closely associated with youth culture, with hip hop culture, which is the central force of, you know, popular music essentially. And you know, them speaking about that football's great, but it doesn't sell sneakers and you can't see the players. These are all just such, you know, to my understanding, at least, such real financial factors. And mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, basketball would go away because the owners don't want it to be around for a bit because they're holding their cards. You just have to imagine in an accelerated culture like this, something would have to pop up. And there's just too much money and too many fans, not even just in North America, but around the world, that it's just the supply and demand process would cause something to pop up. And it's just that's just one very interesting idea that's, you know, the backdrop to this entire movie that has other interesting things about it, but mm-hmm. there is that sort of central notion that moves everything along, and it seems so real, and it will seem extremely real in 2021.
Yeah exactly. And under the assumption that that there is a lockout, yeah, there's got to be something. Like, it's hard for me to imagine that LeBron couldn't make more money than he currently makes in the NBA if he just sort of started setting up his own thing. Like, because he's just, I know he's the 1% of the NBA, which is the 1% of the 1%. But he, like, some players achieve a level of fame where, like, he doesn't have to be a part of the NBA to make the amount of money that he's making. And yeah, I just think that's interesting to think about. But how do
no,
we...
I think that's... just one more thing. I think that's a good point because, as we said, they talk about the Stephs and LeBrons and Durants as the few that have power. And I think that this is very much a movie about power and about exclusivity and, you know, being that 1%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Raven says, you know, that's when he's talking to Eric, he says, those million people who record a game, fast forward it and just watch the good parts, we have them. Like, yeah. It's there is this massive, you know, it is such a behemoth, and there's just a way to try to get people to kind of corner them and use the control. And I think that's all over this movie. You know, that's over Ray, that's different agents speaking with Eric, that's Ray speaking with the owner, Ray speaking with Spence, his boss, and that other player's mother. You know, it's all under this, within this realm of basketball and the not NBA, but it's such a persistent theme in this movie. And so it's interesting to see it play, these power dynamics played out in interpersonal relationships, to be played out in business relationships, to be played out in these more adversarial relationships as well. It's just something that is draped over this entire film.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of two, like, one-on-one conversations, basically, is the majority of this movie. And most of those conversations take place from at least a vaguely adversarial standpoint. And yeah, it's a competition of sorts, and everybody's squaring off in a different way in each scene. And I think that interestingly reflects the level of competitive desire somebody needs to have to be in the NBA or work within the NBA in some capacity. You know, like, agents have to be competitive shit too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and we see in the first conversation between Ray and Eric at that... well, they're having dinner together at that restaurant, or lunch, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we get these shots from the side. And, I mean, the camera it doesn't move around a ton during shots, but we just get so many camera angles and so many setups in this movie, which we'll get to, I'm sure.
Yeah, there are 14 distinct setups in that scene.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say, so there's a ton there, and then Ray says something very confrontational, we'll say, involving the phrase "daddy's dick" to Eric, and it's the first POV shot, I believe, first time we really get them face on. And
is that the cut to when Eric's like cut to looking at Eric and he's saying pause?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was just a very early but interesting use of these power dynamics, and that angle of it, you know, this confrontation being told through the cinematic language. And this movie clearly loves these setups. You said there's 14 in that one. Yeah. And so some of it may be like, some of it's, you know, flashy. Some of it's, I think, just kind of to keep things propulsive and kinetic and keep things interesting. But then there's also clear, you know, storytelling purposes behind a shot like that. So
yeah,
if you want to give us anything more about those setups or just the entire visual look of this movie, because it's fun. It's nothing but not fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think that scene is something I really spent a lot of time looking at. And because it is such an interesting way to start your movie. And it reminded, I mean, I'm always thinking about this movie, so it's not that hard to remind me of it, but it reminded me a little bit of the opening sequence of The Social Network. And just how there's this long, intense conversation that touches on a lot of different subjects, and it requires its actors to be incredible, and it involves you. It involves the filmmakers needing to make two people sitting across from each other and not moving at all look interesting. And yeah. there's a lot more setups in this movie or in this movie's opening scene. You know, it starts with that tracking shot in as we're introduced, as the Bible gets handed off to Ray, who then gives it to Eric in the scene. But yeah, and then we just cut around, and the camera cuts across the axis. It works its way across the axis, so you're on the opposite side of the table than you were at the beginning of the sequence, and then it works its way back again, which is really interesting. And then finally it comes across the table one more time, and Soderbergh crossing the axis three different times in one scene might be the most Soderbergh thing he's ever done. But yeah, what you're saying with those shots where we're looking directly at the character, like we get, I don't think it's quite the shot that you were describing. Like, it's kind of a POV shot, but it's too low angle to be a proper POV shot. So I feel like we're not supposed to be seeing out of Ray's eyes in that. We're seeing a bit lower than his eye line would be, right? Like, because the camera's looking up at Eric. And the same is true of the reverse. It's not quite a POV shot from Eric. And then we get that shot from of both Eric and Ray, like, separately from above, those high-angle shots. And I think the reason there are so many angles in that sequence, and I know on the day they shot it, like, they didn't shoot the whole scene from every angle. They shot these pieces from the angle that Soderbergh, who also edited this movie, famously, he's his own editor.
The Night Of.
Yeah, exactly. famously, he's his own editor and DOP. But, he, you know, he's marking off in the script where he's going to edit so that, you know, Andre Holland and Melvin Gregg don't have to use so much energy, just so that Soderbergh has the safety of having to, or making the decisions more complicated in the editing room. He likes making these decisions up front, which is the positive thing about being an editor, a director who also edits. But I think the idea behind why there are so many angles is that is a sequence built around, we're being introduced to Ray, who is our lead character in this movie, and Ray is seeing all the angles, right? And that's what he does throughout this movie. He sees all the angles. He sees everything from all these different perspectives. Until the very end, we get that last shot. And it's sort of this high angle, this kind of bizarre looking two shot where there's too much room above the table. And that's when the restaurant staff comes in to tell Ray his card is declined, right? As he's tried to pay for the coffee or whatever that they're eating or drinking. And he sees all the angles, and or at least he thinks he does, right? And he's able to be in this nice place. And then this woman comes in and lets him know that he doesn't control the money. So he doesn't actually see everything. And you see Andre Holland, like, thinking about something as he's like spinning his card still in this two shot, his credit card, his company card. And I think that's the beginning of him being like, okay, I realize I don't control as much as I think I do, and I need to take some steps to do so. And I think the journey begins with that shot, and that's when Ray really starts to kick things into high gear. And also, just as a fun visual thing, that shot ends with a, like, it's a pretty long take, and then that shot just whip tilts up, like tilts very high, very fast up into the air, and then we come to outside tilting down really quickly on Ray looking at his phone. And it's just a nice transition, but yeah, I think that's the point of the scene, is that we're setting up Ray as somebody who sees all the angles until the person in charge of the money comes up with an angle that he couldn't see.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfect read of it, because what Ray, and I'm paraphrasing slightly just because I don't remember, but he's saying to Eric, you should be thinking, what's this guy's angle? Or, you know, he's like, you should be thinking, why is this guy being so nice to me? He's explaining to him, look at it from different angles. You should mm-hmm. be taking somebody else's perspective. Why is somebody loaning you money? Why, like, you're only thinking about what you were getting out of this guy's offer, and you weren't thinking about what this guy is getting out of you. And so, yeah, this idea of playing with the angles, and the comparison to Social Network, it's, you know, seemingly the least interesting way to start a movie is a two-person discussion about something. But yeah, there is that element of visual storytelling where this notion of looking at things through different angles is completely applicable to their discussion, and more so from Ray's point of view, who is the character that we're going to see the most of. We see plenty of Eric as well, but this is definitely a movie more about Ray than about any other character. So mm-hmm. I think it's appropriate that we get all these angles because, you know, as you said, that is what he does, or at least tries to do. And yeah, I hadn't really considered how kind of stark and off-putting that one angle is when he realizes that something is amiss and he's not able to pay for this meal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What did you, even before that, what did you think of that shot that starts sort of on the city and then through the low window or whatever that is, and then through the hallway and then to the dinner scene?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was this actually doesn't happen that frequently in this movie, but a Soderbergh trademark is starting the dialogue from a scene before you see the characters that are speaking it. And that's sort of a different way than he usually does it. Usually, like, say Jude Law in Contagion finishes a piece of dialogue and then we just hold on Jude Law's face in a close-up as he's thinking about something, while Matt Damon's dialogue from the next sequence begins for 10 seconds or whatever. And then after 10 seconds of looking at Jude Law and listening to Matt Damon, we finally cut to Matt Damon talking.
Finally get some Matt Damon.
Yeah. Finally get away from that hideous Jude Law to Matt Damon. But that's sort of the same principle. It's just the intro is different because, you know, there was no previous scene.
Yeah.
Other than Reggie Jackson talking about coming into the league. But that's sort of the Soderbergh staple. It's like we hear these people talking. We don't know who these people are. We don't know who this woman is that's walking. I mean, we never really find out who she is, but yeah. But we at least learn her purpose eventually. And but yeah, we're introduced to the ideas before we see the faces, and that's a Soderbergh staple. So I loved it, and I love it when Soderbergh does that type of stuff. There's another moment later in this movie where we've got a like 30-second close-up on Sam as a scene begins, while Eric and Ray are having a conversation in Ray's apartment, and we're just looking at Sam, who is not speaking. And eventually, before the close-up ends, we hear her talk, but we're looking at her for like 20 seconds before she says anything while other people are talking around her.
Right. And I want to talk about more of the Soderbergh staples and signature moves mm-hmm. and themes in a second, but just quickly right after that intro restaurant scene, and you touched on it a bit, we get Ray outside, he's counting his money and he's walking to the office. That feels so much like a credit sequence with no credits. Do you have a reason why?
No, you're 100% right. I think, like, if you had said the opening credit sequence, I would have just immediately assumed you were talking about that walk. Yeah, you're right. I don't know. I bet there's a time where at some point in the fine tuning of the edit, like Soderbergh used that as a credit sequence and then was just like, whatever, we don't need credits, you know?
Yeah, okay.
So
So then what else is, oh, sorry, did you have something more there?
No, I think, I've just never thought about that, and now you're just really throwing me for a loop. Oh, an opening credit sequence without the credits, another a new way of looking at movies by Steven Soderbergh.
Oh, it's got the song, it's got just not a lot happening.
Yeah, like, I mean, the song is both Richie Havens songs, the one that opens the movie and the one that closes the movie, are very thematically like on the nose. The song High Flying Bird is basically a song about feeling trapped and the only way to ascend is to die, right? And at that point, Ray feels very trapped and maybe feels like the only way out is to die, but he's going to try and find another way. And I think opening credit sequences can do that with a song and also have the credits. But I do think that walk is important, if only to hear as much of the song as we do. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So what other, elements or themes, whichever you want to tackle first, of Soderbergh's do we get here?
I mean, all of Soderbergh's movies are about, or most of Soderbergh's movies, I'm sure there are outliers, is who controls the money and how money controls you. That's a constant in Soderbergh's filmography, and also just controlling your own life is a big theme, and feeling like you're in control of your life, or learning that you're not in control of your life.
Yeah, and that's Ray, Eric, Sam, Myra. I mean, most people who have more than five lines in this movie are
exactly,
you can't really vocalize about wanting to work for themselves or be their own boss or take control of their career more strictly.
Exactly. And Spence is really the only person who is comfortable with what his life has become. And he has, it's not like he views the world as like, everything's great. I'm Spence.
Yeah.
But he really worries about where kids go from his camp, but at least the world he operates in and controls, I think he feels very comfortable and pretty happy. And all of his worries are related to what happens to kids after they leave his camp. So I think that just the theme of control and also money are the main Soderbergh things thematically that are in this movie.
Right.
Yeah. And as far as his style, I think cutting across the axis, as I've pointed out, there's another moment where Myra says to Sam after they meet in the car, come work with me, we could use you. And then Sam, we cut across the axis again as Sam says, I don't like to be used. It's like the control has totally switched over to Sam. Like, she sort of runs that conversation, she walks off, she gets to put the button on it. That was a very Soderberghy sort of thing, because that cut comes after a pretty long take, and the way that it's communicated that we're going to Philadelphia with the train conductor talking over the entire montage of Ray going to Mrs. Umber's house. That's very Soderbergh, and just a time shift late in the movie felt very, very Soderbergh to me.
Oh, yeah. 24 hours ago.
48 hours ago, then 24 hours ago, yeah.
Right, yes, yeah. Yes.
Those are the really Soderbergh things to me. And this movie... this movie feels like a Soderbergh movie where he really listened to his co-collaborators, because it doesn't feel quite like something like Logan Lucky, where it felt like that's him through and through sort of thing. And I think it's really interesting. Like, this is 100% in the upper third of Soderbergh movies to me. I think it's fantastic. And I love the way that you never really know, like, there's a lot unsaid in this movie. There's a lot for you to fill in the blanks on yourself as a viewer. And that will always go a long way with me, regardless of who the filmmakers are. But I also enjoy that the inception of this movie is Andre Holland and Steven Soderbergh essentially wanting to work together again. Andre Holland was essentially the lead on The Nick. And they just were talking in a room, like, what are things that interest both of us? And they got to professional sports. Andre Holland is a longtime friend of Terrell McCraney, so they brought him in. and just the way that the three of them sort of seemingly work together in concert. And I think it's really important to point out how much influence Andre Holland had on the making of this movie, the inception of this movie, because if he was more famous, we'd be like going gaga for how much of a producing role he played in this movie. So I think he deserves props for that. But it just does feel like a movie made by Soderbergh and collaborators more than Soderbergh himself. And I know that he was instrumental in the writing process. Soderbergh was, by suggesting things, but also a co-writer of Moonlight wrote the screenplay. So obviously that person's going to have a lot of control. But the Chekhov's Bible, as you mentioned it to me via email, that having something like that was Soderbergh's idea. And that's a very Soderbergh thing, because that, again, is a sense of mystery that runs throughout the movie.
Did Chekhov lose claim to Chekhov's gun? Soderbergh
took it. Just another one of his classic surprises. I say all this to point out that this movie is very much about race. Steven Soderbergh is white, and there was a point towards the when they're getting ready to shoot, or they're starting to shop it and thinking about who's the director going to be, and his story is that he offered to step back if they felt like it was sort of a weird thing to have a white person directing a movie that's so explicitly about how black people are treated in this world. And they're just like, no, you're the right person for this story. And I think that's really cool that, I mean, he's done so much producing work. He still would have had an effect on this movie as a producer, but
yeah.
The idea that he's willing to take a step back on something, I think really speaks to a lot of the things I like about Steven Soderbergh as a human being, or at least the version of a human being that he projects to the public. And I don't know. I feel like it's worth pointing out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we can get back to more specifically to this movie, but I just had one more Soderbergh question as well. I hope that's okay with you.
I think I will survive it.
Just speaking of the idea of him not doing this, and, you know, he's made a lot of things and he kind of works at a pretty good clip, is my understanding. Do you think it's tougher to kind of conceptualize and pin down a director when they're very prolific, or even a musician? You know, someone like Prince or Bob Dylan just has so much music that by the time they're done, it seems harder to get your arms around, you know, 40 movies or 50 albums than it does with somebody who didn't necessarily die young, but just didn't work as much and was just, selective is not the right word, but someone who just, you know, simply didn't have the output. Or do you think just because of the sheer, you know, amount of data you can comb through for themes and techniques, that it's you find a more accurate sketch?
I think it's so in my head, I'm sort of picturing the Steven Soderbergh versus like Paul Thomas Anderson, somebody who doesn't work a lot, right?
Yeah.
So Steven Soderbergh, I feel like it's easier to follow the path or to get a feel for somebody who's prolific, because you're seeing from film to film, you're seeing the interest sort of transition. Like if you're somebody like me who sees every Soderbergh movie as fast as humanly possible, you know, you just sort of are able to see his interests changing in real time because he never stops working. Whereas you've got somebody like Paul Thomas Anderson, right? So look at There Will Be Blood to The Master. There's five years in between. Those two movies visually look so different. The way the story is told is kind of different. And you just have to do a lot more research on the movie to sort of feel where the person was coming from, since they've taken more time off. Or in the case of The Master, he just wasn't able to get funding to make it as fast as he wanted. The person becomes more impenetrable the less they work, and the more that they work and the more that they're giving you, it's just the more that they're giving you as a person. Like the more you talk to a human being, the more information you get from them, the more you feel you have an accurate sense of who they are. And there's always going to be contradictions in a human being, like certain things that are different about Unsane and from High Flying Bird you know, they're both shot on iPhones, but there's different stylistic choices. One's a good movie, one's not. But
big difference.
Yeah. But you're always going to be able to see, you're just going to be able to see the transition a lot more smoothly. Whereas if he goes from Logan Lucky, takes 2 years off or whatever, and then High Flying Bird comes out, like, it's a much bigger jump, you know?
Yeah. No, that means that, that absolutely makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, it's basically like a good friend or somebody you see once every 6 months. It's that's the comparison.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
And so before Soderbergh heisted Chekhov's gun and turned it into his, what did you think the Bible was, or did you spend any time thinking about it?
I think I thought about it. Sorry, I guess I didn't think about it. I wouldn't have thought about it because that scene moves so quickly. The scene where it's introduced.
Right.
And I think the way that the movie moves, it doesn't hit it hard enough. Like, it comes up, I think, two other times before the ending, but only very briefly. And every scene in this movie moves so quick and is so dense with dialogue that you just don't really have a lot of time. So yeah. I can't say I thought about it, but I love that the end of this movie is somebody looking at a book. Like, that's the best. You know, I'm as somebody who was recently speaking highly about the children's television program Ghostwriter because it was essentially pro reading propaganda, I'm very pro the reveal at the end of this movie. Just, hey, you should read. Yeah, I love it. So it does seem like something you would think about more throughout the movie, though. So I'm curious if you thought anything about it.
Yeah, and I'll agree with your points that it's not like there's a ton of scenes of him, of Eric almost opening it and, you know, or just kind of shaking it in his hand and soliloquizing or anything. but no, I thought it was money. I just thought it was some of the money that Ray had put away. For a rainy, exactly. Lovely turn of phrase.
Yeah.
I just thought it was going to be this illustration of how far ahead he had thought, that he'd put this money aside, that Eric was just about to leave Ray or do something rash, and found, like, I thought he maybe would just get into large money troubles. And, you know, end up doing something very stupid and looking for this Bible. I know he didn't realize it was a Bible, but looking to this Bible at the last moment, and seeing that Ray really did have him covered, and that Ray was just this, very bright, very practical man who was very good at thinking ahead and, save his client.
Yep. Yeah. No, for sure.
And so, before we get to the ending, there's just a couple more shots that I want to talk about too.
We haven't mentioned that this movie's shot on an iPhone, and I think it's worth talking about that a little bit.
Yeah, so yeah, we did mention that in passing, and we mentioned Unsane, and we won't return to this rabbit hole too deeply, I don't think, but Soderbergh just being someone who, I think he thinks himself as someone on the cutting edge and is very just open to new techniques of storytelling and of filmmaking. And
absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
More than anybody of his stature, 100% he is.
Okay, right.
And second place is not close.
Okay. Yeah. And so, one, I think of you as more of a traditionalist and who likes things that aren't iPhones and Netflix, as less than some other people. Mm-hmm. And kind of how you, you know, negotiate those things. But just what about this movie? Is it just his ability to go home and watch it quickly and edit it quickly that is the appeal to him? Or is it him just going out there with something that maybe he doesn't fully understand and just seeing what it can do for him? And what in this movie, you know, what's done in this movie that wouldn't be done otherwise or couldn't be done otherwise?
So I think it's a lot of it is the speed that it allows him to work at. That's the thing he likes a lot, and also the camera setup. So let's go back to that scene towards the beginning or the very beginning. Those shots of the high angle looking down at Andre Holland, right? that takes time to set a camera up like that. If you're setting a big, heavy, quote-unquote movie camera up, takes time to set that up. You have to have people monitoring it. You have to make sure that the camera doesn't fall on Andre Holland. So you have to secure it really well, which means you need more crew members and just more time to do all these things. Whereas if you're think of an iPhone, and also you can see Soderbergh, if you just look for behind the scenes photos from this movie, you can see the sort of tripod setup that Soderbergh uses. It's very small and clearly very light. And so you can just sort of put it wherever, and then Soderbergh like stands on an Apple box to monitor the shot as he shoots downward. And so that sequence, which I think is like 12 pages of dialogue according to Soderbergh, is something that they were able to shoot in 2.5 hours. Whereas The Social Network, the comparison scene, I mean, they're not that different qualitatively in their work, but Fincher and Soderbergh, as far as how they work and the speed at which they work, exact opposite of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I forget how many days they shot that Social Network sequence for, but I think it was a number of weeks. And it's just sort of the speed that it allowed him to work at. And I think that, you know, he has said that you could make this movie at 5 times the budget and, you know, use bigger cameras, but, and use the larger crew that it would require to use those cameras. But he says he doesn't think it would be a better movie. And you just need to be willing to work with the tools that, that assist the idea. And this is a small movie with people talking in rooms. Like, he compares it a lot to his next movie, The Laundromat, which is his Panama Papers movie, which sounds fantastic and uses a lot of different, he's mixing a lot of different styles from a lot of different time periods. And it basically sounds like the cocaine equivalent of the movie to me. And he describes that as, that's a movie where you need $30 million or whatever to do it right. This one, if you have $30 million, is not necessarily a better movie. And that opening credit sequence that we've described, the opening credit sequence that's not an opening credit sequence, they just shot that in a couple hours while they're just walking through the streets, right? Like, you don't need a location permit when you're shooting on an iPhone. And I would bet heavily that that shot on the train as Andre Holland is going, or Ray is going to Philadelphia, I'd bet heavily that there's just no clearance with Amtrak or whatever train they're riding on. They just shot that on the train, you know, and they found the most empty car and were just like, we'll steal this shot because we don't need all this fancy stuff because we're working with such a small camera. And again, the amount of minimalizing the crew just helps so much. And it sounds like a weird thing, but the fewer people you have to talk to on a film set, the easier it makes the production and the faster it allows you to go. And that's really where Soderbergh is coming from. And also just the angles it allows you to have, you know, like there's just, and one other thing is the camera is just physically small. So it's easier for the actors to ignore, which is another thing that can't be downplayed enough. Shouldn't be downplayed. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Any other shots?
There's a handful. The shot through Myra's car window, when Sam goes to catch up with her and sit in the car, just as we don't realize we're looking out a window, the door opens, the camera pulls back a little bit, and Myra gets in the car. That's a cool shot that, you know, you would need the iPhone for. The wide shots of backcourt day, like they really do a good job of using the one time when they have a bunch of extras in this movie, just of doing some actual like cool staging. And for sequences, these tracking shots, it's Soderbergh holding a phone on an Osmo, which is like a little stabilizer that you can just, it's like a little stick that you hold in your hand. And he's being pushed in a wheelchair. And that's how they're getting their dolly shots in this movie, and which is just fantastic. Oh, okay. Yeah,
yeah. No, I was curious about that, of how funny these, like a gigantic crane with an iPhone on the end.
You can't find photos of Soderbergh in a wheelchair on an Osmo for this movie. I feel like there are some on Unsane, but because it looks really funny. but it's effective. And the wide shot, or sorry, the behind the bar, that shot through the rocks or the glasses of garnishes. That's a phone leaning against a bar. And that's a shot that's extremely hard to do with a proper camera. And things like that that populate the movie that I think make it worth it. And and yeah. I will say, it's like the wide shots on this camera, he's using lenses that are made by Moondog Labs, and they're like they're anamorphic lenses, so they basically turn your phone into an anamorphic lens. And like early Paul Thomas Anderson movies are shot anamorphic. A lot of the Spielberg 70s movies, like Raiders, is an anamorphic movie. It's just sort of this just different sort of slightly distorted vibe. And it's the first time I've seen something shot on a phone where I was like, this looks great. I disagreed with Soderbergh on how Unsane looked. I didn't think it looked good. I didn't like the look he was going for, but on this I was like, cool. And on really wide shots, like when you see Ray from afar standing in the middle of Backcourt Day giving his speech, you know, when you can't see as much detail, those shots like look gorgeous. And same with when that shot of Kyle MacLachlan walking towards the airplane, that super wide shot, like,
yeah,
those are incredible shots. And I think if you had shown me those separately, I would never have guessed they were shot on an iPhone. Like, they look like a proper camera. And there are problems with shooting on an iPhone. Soderbergh's been very open about how even when you're using the right apps and the right lenses, there are little like weird color flickers, and that he had to spend a lot of time in color correction fixing, putting power windows over little things. But yeah, we're getting pretty close to it not really making sense to use a giant camera for movies like this.
Close to peak iPhone.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the one of the shots through the garnishes or over through whatever. Mm-hmm. I took a note of that one really quickly just because it was fun and cool looking. And then I thought about someone's phone leaning, yeah, just on a bar. And, exactly. You know, I wasn't considering just the setup and production aspects of it at that time. I liked it as a shot, not thinking of the ease of it or the complication of it or, you know, any of the factors that someone making a film would have to look into. I just liked it and then thought about it more, and it was fun. And am I wrong in thinking that in one of the discussions between, what's Zachary Quinto's character's name?
Star is his last name.
Okay, Star then. Yeah. He sort of slams down what appears to be a vitamin water.
Yeah.
And his desk shakes and the camera shakes a little bit.
Yep.
Yeah, that was rather charming to me too.
Yeah, there's a couple moments where the camera shakes, and in another interview that I read, Soderbergh talks about how, because when you're in doing the color process, that's when somebody can throw on some stabilizing pretty easily, and they'll always ask him, "Do you want to stabilize this shot or that shot?" And because it is a very natural camera shake, so the first time I saw it, I was wondering like, is this something that just couldn't be fixed, or is this something they didn't try to fix? Chances are they did not try to fix it, because Soderbergh just likes to leave those things in there. I mean, there's a shot I always think of in Out of Sight where an extra just misses their mark and kind of stands in front of the camera for a second, and then the camera has to move over to the side a little bit, and he obviously left it in the movie because, like, I think basically anytime a mistake is made with the camera, Soderbergh's gonna leave it in the movie. I suppose that's another Soderbergh-ism.
Yeah.
Keeping the human element in filmmaking. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about some of the bigger themes? This might bring us up to the ending, but the phrase that, this notion of the game on top of the game, mm-hmm. and, you know, what we talked about earlier, that there is this, this sort of Marxist notion of the workers taking back the means of production, and mm-hmm. how this applies to sports, and how this applies to the book that the Bible, the reveal by the end. Mm-hmm. It's to me one of the most interesting things about this movie. You know, it's interesting in its filmmaking, as we've discussed. It's got some good performances. It's got a lot of things going for it, but I think it's something that makes me think about things that aren't movies. That seemed to be the biggest thing for me by a decent stretch. And we just haven't spent a lot of time talking about it, and I would feel very remiss if we didn't. So, mm-hmm. Did you have anything just on that subject generally? And did you know that we were getting this sort of manifesto-ish angle to a movie?
No.
High Flying Bird?
I did not. I was on board with it. No, I didn't. And I like it. And I think that leads us Can we table it for 1 second while we just talk about the, like, because I do think that leads us right into the ending. And one thing I really appreciated about this movie is the way that it questions words we just use, like, reflexively. The most obvious one is anytime somebody, like, uses some form of slavery terminology on Spence's court. I think if you remember any line from this movie other than they built a game or invented a game on top of the game, it's Spence making people say, "I love the Lord and all his black people." And what that is meant to do is show how what he's trying to do, what I think he's trying to do, again, this movie doesn't explain a lot of its characters' motives at all times. What I think Spence is trying to do is get people away from using slavery-related terminology in day-to-day life. And this happens 4 or 5 times in the movie, and it just sort of, it's meant to point out to you that just how entrenched that sort of, like, reflexive linguistic use of slavery terminology is in regular life. And I really enjoyed that.
Even Spence uses it.
Exactly. Yeah. It happens. And I think the only time it happens where it just feels a little like they threw it in to have one more is when it happens with Myra. I forget what she says, something about being in New Orleans, and it just felt a little like less natural than every other time it's used. But the idea that people use this weird outdated terminology to talk about things, especially in sports constantly, is really interesting to me. And I think about it all the time. Anytime an announcer calls like a player a beast, it always makes me uncomfortable, but people do it all the time. It's going to happen in the Raptors game tonight 100 times about Kawhi. And there's just like terminology like, oh, he's an animal on the boards, all of these things. And one of my favorite books is this book called Black Planet by David Shields. And he basically follows, he lives in Seattle, or at least did in the 90s, follows the Sonics for a year. And they, like, he's such a weirdo. They revoke his media pass like 20 games into the season. And he's just following radio broadcasts and television broadcasts and all, how they're reported in the media. And the whole thing is him analyzing the way NBA players are described in the media. And it has always been lodged in my head. And, I think about it anytime I accidentally refer to a human being as a machine or an animal or a beast. I think about it and just how frequently athletes are dehumanized simply because they work harder on their bodies than the average human being. And I think this movie's very obsessed with language and how language is used to describe human beings. And I think that's great, and it always makes me happy. And we pointed out the use of the term "used" earlier that Sam takes slight objection to. There's a handful, or probably 2 or 3 times, when a distinction between boys and men is pointed out, to be confused with Motown Philly Boys to Men, but and it's used in regards to both the players and owners, so the owners get a little dehumanized with that as well. And there's predatory language, like right in the first sequence, Ray describes the person that gave Eric a loan. He says he went out to catch him a rookie, you know, like he's a shark, basically, this person with the loan. And I think the way that this movie is very obsessed with our language choices is one of my favorite things about the movie, if not my actual favorite thing about the movie.
Just speaking, I mean, the language element of it being this one way that, you know, this movie asks us to look at the world around us and reassess it and say, mm-hmm. you know, we speak the way that we speak because we hear the people around us speak that way. But then, just that reassessing of things. And, you know, you can zoom out and look at that at what's happening with these leagues, and that, oh, it's this way because it's been this way. So it should continue this way because this is how it functions. But you can tell that the people involved in making this film are interested in maybe not hitting the reset on everything, but mm-hmm. looking at things as though they had, or assessing things for their true nature and not giving things a pass because that's how things exist. Mm-hmm. And that gets you, I mean, that kind of thinking of not questioning it gets people in, to put it very lightly, all kinds of trouble. Like that's allowing things to continue because it existed that way before you opened your eyes to it, is the way that all the bad things continue to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And the ending of this movie isn't like a total upheaval of the system. It's changing within the system. You know, I think that's one of the cool things that happens at the end of the movie is Ray realizing like some things are too entrenched to like start change over entirely, but you can make adjustments from inside as long as you get the right people around you. And I think that's really interesting because one, I think the main thing that would stop players from doing this is that players live such a repetitive, single-minded lifestyle. Like to be an NBA player, you're up at 5 a.m. every day. You have your workout regimen. You eat what you eat. At the same time, you have your nap before the game. All of these things, your life is so regimented, and it's regimented for so long. And that if you change that to give up the amount of time it would take to sort of start something totally new, you would immediately fall behind on the court, right? And so what this movie's showing us is that you need a player and an agent to, or somebody like Ray, who's an agent or whatever he's going to be at the end of the movie, somebody that's willing to do the willing and able to do those business things. And that's why we get sold Ray as somebody whose blood is in the game, whose heart is in the game, all of this stuff. We get sold that stuff up front because you need, if you're the player, you need to be able to trust that person entirely to run your business while you're working out and trying to keep up with LeBron, you know? And that, I think that's the biggest hurdle to get over is a player couldn't do it by themselves. They need somebody to manage the business, but they also need to have somebody good enough to manage the business side of things, who they can trust 100% and who won't screw them over, which is, at this level, probably very hard to find, you know? And the thing I like the most about this movie, even more than its use of language, is that you realize at the end it is a series of people acting as individuals, right? Most of these scenes are one-on-one conversations that are kind of adversarial. And Ray uses different people throughout the movie. He sets up Mrs. Umber. He hacks Eric's Twitter account to start the Twitter beef, which is I assume how that starts, and he's doing all these things to put all these people versus against each other. But at the end, he's even got an adversarial relationship with his boss Star, and the idea is that he's going to take Star's job because he essentially ended the lockout. But the majority of the movie is people working in isolation. But at the end of the movie, as soon as he gets some sort of seniority, he brings in Dr. Harry Edwards, who wrote the book that is the Bible, which is called The Revolt of the Black Athlete. And we've got Sam and Eric, who are still hanging out together. And I love that Sam is the one that opens the Bible as opposed to Eric. I can't put it into words why, but I like it. And the reason she has to be the one to read it is because she has to encourage Eric to read it so that they can sort of be a sort of team. And you can see the future happening because you've now got an agent who is in a senior position at this this agency who's bringing in Harry Edwards to sort of presumably work together in some capacity. He's now got an ally in the players union working under Myra and Sam. And it seems like him and Myra get along together. And also it seems like he's able to sway Myra's opinion a little bit. Myra kind of doesn't seem to really ever draw a line in the sand. She's just kind of sees what's happening in front of her and doesn't really change things. She's sort of managing more than anything, I suppose. And he's also got an ally in Eric. Even though Eric just fired him, you know, they have a pretty amicable au revoir because Ray knows he's staying at the agency and Ray now has a more senior role. So he's still going to be working with Eric in some capacity. And so he's got all of these allies now. And the main core of the movie, or the idea of the ending of the movie, is that it's all these people working together or working as individuals is what has created all of these rifts and allowed us to get to the system that we have now. And the only way to fix it is to work together and work together at different levels and different jobs. And I think that's fantastic. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I was, as I kind of touched on in an email to you about things to question, questions about this movie, is that in that heisty element that we've talked about, is that, you know, we get this reveal near the end, or at least Star gets this reveal, but we do as well, that so much of this was Ray's doing, and that he was kind of a puppet master, and 72 hours ago, everybody was in trouble, and Ray did X, Y, and Z, and now things are back on. You know, the sand of the oasis is wells running again. whatever clunky metaphor was mangled by Star there. And you know, things are back to normal. It's the way a movie ends. You know, that there was order, and then there was chaos, and there's order restored. Mm-hmm. But in a movie that says something about the status quo, like this movie does, something negative about the status quo, that, you know, there's this game on top of the game, that the people who are creating all this revenue are not the people benefiting it from as much. You know, the owners are getting so much, and that there's, you know, some players, you said, like LeBron can make money no matter what happens in these situations, but there's so many people who are unable to do that. And so for order to be restored, in a movie that seems to say something subversive, is counterproductive. But what you're getting at, I think, is that order is not restored in the sense that we are right back to where we started. We're not at square one. We have this league functioning again, but we have people's eyes opened. We have important people's eyes open. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, we have people in place who can make systemic changes to this problem. And that's, you know, you can have anecdotal changes, you can have these, you know, small people who think things, but to have this notion of people, the right people in charge who now have the right motives, getting in places of in power who can make institutional changes, you know, there's order in the sense that the league's functioning, but we have progress, right?
Exactly. Like, the idea is to, because the point of or one of the points of Eric's arc is that he doesn't have money. He needs money because he's a lockout rookie. Like, he came into the league and can't sign a contract because there's a work stoppage. Yeah, exactly. And and Reggie Jackson, conveniently, one of the interviewees was a lockout rookie as well. And the idea that he's sort of he's got his dream, but he also can't afford to live. And the idea at the end of the movie is that we've got to get the well going again, because players get screwed over a lot more than the business people. And the idea is, as soon as these things are going again, and as soon as the league is operating again, players get paychecks again, it's up to us to continue to try and build something that can be different for the next time this happens, so that we're a more formidable opponent next time there's a labor strike. Because my reading of the 2011 lockout has always been, and I have a pretty simplistic view of it. Like, it's not like I really dive into it, but that the players lost, like, they made a bad deal. And so I think that, like, they lost a lot of percentage points on the revenue, and I don't know how that got made up on the other end. And I think the way that basketball has gone has gotten infinitely popular since 2011. And I think that if there's some version of this that were to happen by 2021, I think we could have a long lockout, but I think the players could win. And I'm always like, they could benefit hugely. I mean, I say this all the time, but in a battle between a millionaire and a billionaire, I will always root for the millionaire, despite the fact that it's weird referring to LeBron James as the little guy. LeBron James is deeply underpaid. Like, his NBA salary is just, it's not what he's worth. So I would 100% be on the player side. I'd miss basketball, but, you know, don't root for billionaire owners. They suck. Just look at Joe Lacob sitting courtside at one of these finals games. He's clearly an asshole rich dude. But yeah, I think something that I read in a review by Keith Phipps, is his last line of his review is that the movie is less interested in how things end than how they get started. And I think that's a really good way of describing the ending of this.
Yeah.
And it's a very Soderberghy ending, is the ending is the beginning. It's the beginning of the real story. And then again, we get that second Richie Havens song over the end credits, and it's called Handsome Johnny. And the lyrics are basically a list of different wars that Johnny goes into to fight in Korea, Vietnam, all these, Dunkirk gets mentioned, all of these battles through history. And the last one is Birmingham, being Birmingham, Alabama. But the refrain is, it's a long, hard road until we're free. And the very end of the song is a hydrogen bomb and guided missiles coming in from afar, but it's pretty goddamn dark. But the idea is that if you don't keep fighting these battles, then eventually the whole thing's going to get blown up and you're going to lose. And I think that's sort of what Ray is trying to push into existence, is some sort of resistance for the next time this battle begins, so that the owners don't take everything over time.
Well, then we'll have to check back in for a sequel in 2021.
Yeah.
Got that to look forward to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't put it past this team. Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
If there's one thing I've learned about Soderbergh over the years, it's that just if somebody says Soderbergh's making this movie, just assume that he is, because he'll do anything. He'll do anything because he just wants to work, because he's a madman filled with energy. But yeah, thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men, and check back next time.